always do that weird, like, sing-songy hello?
I don't know. But it gives you, like, a trademark.
Hmm. You think I could trademark that? You think it's distinct enough that I could trademark it?
Yeah, you go, hello, Mr. Anderson, and then you just keep going with that.
It is I, the Matrix.
What if they did a Matrix musical?
Have they not yet?
Not that I know of, but it would be perfect. You could even get Neil Patrick Harris and Jonathan Groff in it.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I would watch that.
but yeah. So this movie happened.
Mm-hmm. We're just dispensing with all of the hellos and how is it going. And
oh well, I mean, we could do the
right into the resurrections.
All right, fine. We can hold off on the resurrections for the time being. So let's go through the other like 3 days prior to that. This is Good Friday. How's your time doing?
Yeah. How cold are you? Eat anything good lately? What else did we talk about on this show?
Tiredness.
Of course. How could I forget the tiredness?
Yeah, I feel like that's quintessential to the experience of listening to this podcast.
I slept very badly the past couple of days. I don't know about you.
I did too, but that was because I flew on an airplane from another coast, sure. And the other coast has a different time zone. So go figure.
Mm. And they have some COVID. Did you bring any souvenir COVID home with you?
No. I flew home, and boy, my arm's tired, but my lungs are fine. I was lucky because it is definitely a situation where we both know people who have managed to come down with COVID in situations where they previously otherwise would not have, and have been saturated with different various vaccines at various doses. So you know, it's a little disconcerting.
Everyone's got all the stuff.
Mm-hmm. But at least I didn't do anything wild, like go to Disney World. Definitely didn't do that one. Didn't unnecessarily travel to Atlanta to just be in Atlanta for it to be muggy and drizzly for several days.
Mm.
Yeah.
They use cornstarch in their COVID down there, I think is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think the cornstarch would thicken up the humidity at least. But
yeah,
how is
it crunchy on the outside?
Well, that's if you fry it. But Dan,
yeah, what?
How? Any? Did you get any COVID from sitting in your private home office?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've left the home a few times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, spoken to some people, seen some people, but I don't think so. I'm continuing to cross my fingers that it doesn't make its way through all of the strong masks and distancing that I do. But you know.
Yeah.
Tis the times.
Tis certainly the times. I don't know. I was really looking forward to... There was that like brief period in... What was it? May? July? June area? Where it was like, wow, vaccines, we're done. And it's like, no. No. No.
You're not done. We're never done. Yeah, whatever. Not to overly date the show or whatever, but uncertain times and such, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, this, interestingly, the film has a scene that takes place on a train car in Tokyo, and the majority of the people on the train car are wearing face coverings. So you have...
It's because they have respect for their fellow humans.
I know, and that's why it was only in Tokyo and not in any of the other scenes in the film.
right in with the social commentary and things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if only we could reboot our own reality to an earlier version where, I don't know, stuff was better for some reason. Although, knowing us, we would reboot our reality to some time where capitalism was even more rampant or something, like the early industrial age kind of time.
Yeah, well, it is one of those things that is difficult. It's like, and I think I would kind of like it if one of these movies, if they continue making them, tackles how do you make a utopia? What are the ingredients for that one? Because
please, everyone in the audience is taking notes. Tell us how the utopia works.
Yeah, because the film can depict dystopia, both the virtual and the real, the glimmers of hope that we've seen in terms of like progress in the human world in this film are not inspiring, shall we say? Like,
have any movies shown Utopia super well? Like, isn't that kind of what Tomorrowland was? I didn't see Tomorrowland, and nobody did, which is probably why nobody in the world has an appetite for Utopia. But I think that's what that movie was about. I don't know.
I mean, it's probably about a failed utopia or something, because otherwise, would you have a dramatic conflict for the movie?
There was a parallel universe thing between regular world and utopia world or something.
Utopia doesn't really exist. The franchises that kind of have something where society in general seems to be good are, you know, things like Star Trek, where it's like the Federation things seem nice enough, but then it's always the conflict of exploring and running into other places and people and things where, you know, people die. So it's just like, well, sort of a utopia, but then the death that happens out in space, where no one can hear you scream. But
it's the other one.
Yeah. It's just, you know, nobody does it, but it would be fine. I would be interested in it, because one of the aspirational things that the Matrix series has had since the initial film is the idea that a human would be empowered at some point to change the virtual reality that all these people are trapped in, to free them or to change the artificial nature of it so that it is more comforting to these people who choose to be there. But we haven't.
The idea that knowledge and free will and the human race banding together against a common enemy would lead to a united ideology and a utopia in Zion.
Yeah. And one of the series' most maligned characters, the Architect, even speaks to how early versions of the Matrix were a utopia for all of the humans, but they were miserable in the utopia.
The human mind couldn't accept it, and they say lots of crops were lost because the programming didn't compute for humans who need their pain, as you like to say.
Yeah, as I like to say. And so this is interesting, just in terms of like the in-universe part of it, like how do you fix the world? You know,
well, I would like to go a little bit higher level to start with this. So
yeah, well, I want we need to talk about how this is a long-awaited sequel that is not necessarily desired or wanted even by the people who are making it.
Right, that article you sent me reminded me. I didn't realize that Warner Brothers had decided to they were making a Matrix with or without the Wachowskis, and then they said, okay, fine, we'll take it over and we'll kind of give you the finger while we're making the movie about the movie and stuff. But my first question is this going to be another trilogy?
I believe the only information that I have is the published sort of denial of, like, you know, this is sort of open-ended where it could be something or it could not be something.
Just our modern world where everything is nothing until it makes a bunch of money and then it's a sequel?
Well, I think this is a situation where they wouldn't want to, I don't think anyone involved wants to embarrass themselves by committing to like a story arc right now off of this. So they're like, well,
just like the first time around.
Yeah.
And that worked out super well for the other two movies.
Well, cause I mean this, I mean, I guess if you're listening to this and you haven't watched the film, I highly recommend you watch the film.
Watch the movie.
Obviously. Because unlike when we talk about like complete Drek on the show, I think it is worth your time. The thing with this movie is that it ends basically in a way that mirrors exactly the ending of the first film, which was this open-ended, I'm going to set everyone free and fix the world thing. And it's basically how we kind of go here. So it's not like at the end of Reloaded where you're going into a next film or something. This is not serialized in that manner.
Reloaded ends, if I recall, with Neo in the coma on the table, and we pan over to see the Meat Space Smith also in a coma. Is that right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, he got out.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's something where they're like building a story that spans movies. And this is not a story that spans movies but this movie,
it's debatable whether the story spans one movie.
It is. Well, I mean, it spans a lot, actually. This movie contains a ton of stuff. It is long too.
Did it feel as long as it is?
I don't think so, oddly enough. And I think that's a compliment, I think, to Lana. Is it Lana or Lana?
I would say Lana, but I don't know that I've heard anyone say it.
So anyway, the pacing of it, I think, goes along at a brisk enough velocity, while not being a jumble of stuff all happening super fast like J.J. Abrams. So you can still feel like you're watching something and being engaged with it, even with the long runtime of 148 minutes, which
there
is
there was only one section of the movie where I kind of rolled my eyes and went like, all right, let me know when this scene's over.
Which one was that?
That was when Mr. Merovingian showed up.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, hey, battle scene time. Remember those characters? Look at them now. They're crazy looking. It's like, cool. Call me when we're moving on to the next.
It's like they found the Lost Boys from Hook. I didn't.
And they're sort of like seafaring ghillie suits made out of seaweed or whatever.
I didn't enjoy. Yeah, that's good. I didn't enjoy that at all, really. I thought that it was a wink and nod of having the Merovingian there, but no one likes the Merovingian, and he doesn't do anything. So
no. He was better when he was a fancy, snooty Frenchman.
Yeah, and that's supposed to be part of the commentary, and the Merovingian is there as this sort of jester figure who is the stuff he's saying during the battle, that his expletives and everything that he's so furious about, is that he's upset that there's no originality and this is all sequels and blah 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 blah, we've been here before, etc. And it is a very meta joke, but I don't feel like it helps the movie or that scene itself. And I understand why they'd want to do that, because this movie pokes not just fun at itself, but says, hey, look at the absurdity of doing this and why we don't want to, and why we all feel like we're being forced into this position. So we might as well make the best of it. So it is not necessarily helpful in this particular scene to have him do that stuff, because I don't feel like that hanging a lantern on it in that scene helps. And the exiles that he's battling are, I struggle to remember. I'm assuming that they were some of the randos that he fights in the chateau, the Merovingian chateau, in the movie, I'm guessing. But it's not the more memorable ones, like the weird ghost twin things, or any of that. So it doesn't have any impact when it's like, oh, it's the exiles. And it's like, I mean, I guess, but like,
it's just a scene of like, did Neo get his groove back or whatever? And can he fight again yet?
Yeah. And it is, I think, a better scene once Neo and Smith are out of there and fighting amongst each other, a la the subway fight from the first film.
For all of the parallel scenes that they redid and, you know, put a new spin on with the new characters and the new reality, but like also it's that sort of deja vu of the older scenes. I don't know. Like, don't get me wrong. I love Jonathan Groff, and I very much enjoy watching him. He's not really a Smith. He's not intimidating, and I didn't need a rehash of that fight, especially because it was not, I don't know, it wasn't shot very engagingly. It was like, all right, they're going to fight, and then, you know, he's strong or whatever, and then he's strong, and then, you know, whatever happens. But, like, I didn't enjoy it the way we sort of marveled at some of the technique or the drama of the filmmaking the first time around.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I don't feel like any of the action in this film is staged or executed to the level of any of the three prior movies. It is kind of surprising to me, because that was one of the things that those movies were known for, but it seems to be of little concern to everyone involved going this time around. I'm curious I don't know if that really impacts much of it story wise, because the movie itself,
different kind of story.
Yeah, because it's not. This isn't like spectacle, like the first film, or like spectacle and self seriousness, like the two sequels. Mm-hmm. So it is in a different place because of how satirical it is in parts. So the action doesn't necessarily stand up as like a serious thing of like, look what we did here. There's certainly not the level of wire work that we saw previously.
Yeah, the office lobby scene from the first one, which, you know, with the propeller head song that everyone remembers, that would not fit in this movie. Or, you know, the helicopter with the minigun freeing Morpheus, like that's the continuation sort of the whole thing. Those scenes were staged and shot very dramatically or with a lot of intent and action, but they would not fit into this movie, which, whatever, it's fine. This movie is a very different movie.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a movie made for a modern 2021 audience, but in the same way, like it also, I think as part of it, yeah, it has to remove a lot of that self-seriousness and it has to be more sort of satirical and commenting on itself. But underneath the, like, you know, all of the reference and the snark and the sort of the commentary of it, there is a story here. And I would also like to separate out and talk about the story because I want to make sure I have it straight, first of all. And then I want to know why they did the thing that they did with the story.
Yeah. So I'm assuming what you're saying when you say the story is you're really talking about the rom-com romance
the rom-com.
Part
I mean,
of this.
Sure. The opening act almost sort of stands alone as like a short film of the whole thing. Like it's, mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting and unique where they sort of, they resurrected Neo and Trinity. We'll come back to why they did that later, but they basically gaslighted them into thinking that they had mental illness, and then everything from the first three movies was like a delusion and they just needed to take their proper medication, but they can channel that mental illness into something usable, like video games. So Mr. Anderson makes a video game called The Matrix, and that's how he sort of tells his story. Like he doesn't go out and, you know, Back to the Future 2 style, like start writing novels about like science fiction characters that he imagined. He makes a video game called The Matrix, and it's apparently like we're treating the first three movies like they were photoreal video games, basically, because we're seeing cutscenes from them, which is basically just footage from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he's battling his visions, his flashbacks, and he has an analyst. Architect, analyst, whatever. He has a therapist, Neil Patrick Harris, who is telling him that, you know, he's been through a lot and he's got this stuff and he's got to take his medication and it's okay. Like, it's okay that you're relapsing into this sort of stuff. But obviously, I think they play pretty well back and forth to sort of, they didn't have me convinced at any point that the prior three movies were all a delusion, because I'm watching a Matrix movie. So, like, that would be kind of like, there's no way you would greenlight a movie where like the ending of the movie was, well, it was all a dream. Like, we're past that. But they did a pretty good job of balancing the whole, like, is he crazy? Like, is this the real world? Like, what's going on here? And then obviously come to find out that he's just been put back in and convinced of a lie again, basically.
Yeah. I would say for me watching it, it seemed obvious that he was in the Matrix trapped, and that he was being given this narrative where he is a video game developer in order to allow him to process his fragments of experience and memory that he had from what was his real life prior to this, because I'm assuming it probably would have not worked as well had they been like, you're a baker now. Like he needed some sort of connection so he could process what he was feeling, because
and they couldn't just fully erase his brain. Like, right. For one reason or another, He's a human. He has innate memories. Like, it's in there, so let's use this to our advantage.
Well, and that's literally Neil Patrick Harris when he shows up later in his awful monologue scene that I don't like. He says as much, is like, the reason why we are able to get this to work is because we keep you and Trinity near, but not, you know, together. And so in order to accomplish this fiction and to manufacture these scenarios, he has to carefully control how near and like how much involvement they have between each other and how much their memories can be evoked or connected between their prior lives and their current lives.
Yeah, the sort of like two strangers passing on the street narrative is enough to validate his memories and sort of convince him that he built a video game on top of that, because he knows there's something in there with Trinity and he just doesn't quite know what. But yeah, the whole that's an interesting way to frame both, like, how to keep him from falling back into thinking that his memories were real and fighting back against the Matrix, but also like keeping them close. There's that bit in there about them being close together but not actually together is better for the Matrix, because it keeps there's something about how it makes it,
it's power output.
It's power output or something, because his angle versus the architect is that when you have an emotional appeal to humans, they produce more energy than if you have sort of just a factual, like, going through blah-de-da robotic daily life matrix world, which I found that to be interesting and compelling, to sort of say like, oh yeah, once you get all the humans riled up, they're going to go through more whatever synaptic jumps in their brain and produce more juice for the Matrix. Like, I got that, but I kind of missed the whole, like, how does that prevent, maybe it's just if you're using the emotional side of your brain versus the analytical side of your brain, you're not going to question your reality as much or something. Anyway, that part was compelling, but it was just a little bit weird, just like, all right, you're going to keep them nearby but not together, and okay, you're covering up his thing there. So that all that stuff is like a good preamble for getting into the story.
But ultimately, why they work as a power dynamo that's better than like a fusion reactor or geothermal energy, I don't know. But
well, you know, it's the Matrix too. Yeah, think of all the energy output and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we ultimately know that the humans living in the real world, the Zion world or whatever, the IO world, I guess, in this one, we're just naming it after other random things. They want to free Neo because, here's where I'm unclear. So it's not the same cut and dry, like, we need to find the one to free as many minds to fight the machines that we think it's going to be, because we come to find out that there has been, since the last time he went in and he did sort of negotiate a detente with the machines, you know, they left the humans alone. They won, quote unquote, won the war. They left the humans alone, and then the humans that are in the Matrix are in the Matrix. But some of the machines apparently admired his self-sacrifice so much that they decided to join forces with the freed humans. So there is this sort of peace on the outside to an extent for past 60 years, apparently. So the purpose of freeing Neo is not to bring an end to the war and prosperity to the human race on the outside in the real world. It's what, something more selfish that these a little bit more ideological free people want to free as many people as possible? I'm unclear as to why they decided to try and track down Neo yet again.
Well, I think the mistake in what you're saying is, like, they're not acting as one thoughtful people energy,
right?
Thing
this
here.
This is not from the high command of IO. This is one ship's worth of people, the lady with the cool blue purple hair.
Yeah, Bugs, as in Bunny, who is played by, what's her, Jessica Henwick, who I was unfamiliar with prior to this. She had seen Neo when she was a window washer and saw through to the real Neo. When he took a step off the roof and the therapist tells him he almost fell, but she says he didn't actually fall.
So apparently his eye contact was so dramatic that is what sort of helped inspire her to free her mind and, you know, get out of the Matrix. Is that what it was?
Yeah, well, that's what she says to Morpheus.
Morpheus.
Yeah.
So kind of like in the first movie where Trinity's given the speech to pre-Neo saying, like, you know, there's something, you know, there's something wrong with the world. You can't really figure out what it is, but you know, there's something there and you want to know more about it or whatever. Like they made some sort of visual connection during the window washing that sort of helped her realize that, you know, something she suspected all along, that the world is not real. And then she finally wanted to investigate and get out of there or something. That's a very tenuous connection that I don't quite buy.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like the way she was describing it is that she made a connection with him that was nonverbal, in terms of what she needed to, the purpose that she felt filled by, as opposed to him literally telling her to rescue him or something. But yeah, she felt compelled to do that. But she was unable
to...
And
if it's as simple as like a, mm-hmm, you kind of saved me with that, so I wanted to save you from the Matrix, because clearly you are stuck and unhappy, as evidenced by the fact that you tried to walk off the building, because clearly there's something going on with you. Maybe I can, you know, return the favor and free you or something there. Like, that didn't really sound like what they were doing, but maybe that's kind of the underlying motivation.
It just seemed like she felt like she was given a purpose from her eye contact there and seeing him and realizing that it was the real Neo, and that, you know, she wasn't where she should be. She was freed later by Nairobi, but that apparently stuck with her over these years. So she's looked for clues for where Neo is since then. And that's what gives us the beginning of the movie, where they find a weird clue in what they call a modal, which appears to be a sandboxed version of the Matrix running within the Matrix.
So not only does Neo have memories of the Matrix from his, whatever, his delusions or his past or whatever it may be, he remembers his sort of like super user controller of the Matrix, to the point that, like, it makes sense that he developed a game called The Matrix, because he remembers the sort of like, I can see the code and programming aspect of it, because he writes his own Matrix, basically.
Yeah. I mean, they don't depict it as in the movie, they show the Matrixy code with the green vertical stuff. And they have him like drag his cursor over it in order to like render a photoreal preview of that area that he's looking at, but it is unclear how much Thomas Anderson is aware of what he's doing versus subconsciously what Neo suppressed in this environment might be doing, because he has created a virtual world inside of a virtual world where he is also pieced together Morpheus and Agent Smith as one person, and that becomes Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who was Dr. Manhattan in the HBO Watchmen series.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he was familiar. But here's one other thing, not to get down to some sort of like recursive logic loophole here, because there's no need to get into that level of detail in this Matrix movie, because it's not trying to do that. He's under Matrix control, because he's still plugged in. Why is he making his own sandbox Matrix and programming himself a Morpheus? Like, why has the Matrix allowed him to do such a thing? Because he doesn't have the free will.
He is plugged into the Matrix, but the Matrix does not control his every action. It can make him doubt and suppress who he really is and convince him that he's someone else. Mm. But it seems as if he made this alternative area, thinking, you know, in his conscious mind that it was a coding thing, and maybe perhaps in his subconscious mind, putting together something based on his actual suppressed memories.
Okay, because, I guess that makes sense. That's kind of how the original Matrix worked, where the machines weren't really controlling your individual thoughts. They were surrounding you with things that sort of, you know, convinced you of a certain reality. They were showing you things that made you on your own believe them. And the reason he became the one is because he was able to look at those things and still know that something is wrong here, and he can see outside of it and stuff like that. So sure, okay, I guess I can buy that he has enough in him still to sort of like make his own Matrix. But anyway, okay, let's just jump into another question I have here.
You know, I didn't make the movie, right? So I don't.
Yeah, no, I know. We need to talk through these things because I watched it and I was like, "There's some interesting stuff here." But
okay.
And again, maybe here's my problem, because by asking these questions, I'm trying to really figure out what the movie is doing, what it's trying to say, and like what its point is with a little bit more detail. And I don't think this movie under it has as much of a point that needs to be interpreted and sussed out as the other ones. But I feel like some of these things are in here for a reason. And I don't understand all of them, which leads me to Smith. Why is Smith here? And why is he Jonathan Groff? And why is he his business partner and pal?
Well, it is... the movie never says why Smith is there, because Smith was thoroughly defeated at the end of the last film.
Yeah, that was the whole point of the end of the last film. Mm-hmm. Like, he plugged into robot head, machine baby head face, so that machine baby head face could kill Smith or burn him out of Neo's brain or something. Or maybe it didn't even burn him out of Neo's brain, it just killed Neo. So maybe Smith is still in Neo's brain, and when they resuscitated him, they're like, oops, we forgot to remove the Smith virus before we resuscitated him, which was stupid, but we took...
Yeah, just like Alien Resurrection. It's a flattering comparison.
Rather than Neo waking up with a split personality of Neo and Smith, they pulled the Smith out and put him into... Not another... Did they put him into a meat space body of Jonathan Groff, or did they just like make him a different program now? I don't know.
They don't spell out... There's a lot about Smith that has left a mystery in this. They don't spell...
That would have been a good post-credit scene if Jonathan Groff showed up at I.O. at the end.
Yeah, well, he's not... But he's not a real person.
We don't know that.
Well, I think the movie is saying that he's not a real person, because he's not interested in... escaping the Matrix as he was in the previous franchise, previous three films.
It doesn't really say whether he's a real person or not, but it absolutely says that his motivation is changing from scene to scene and very stupid.
Yeah, well, he wants to be unrestricted and free from any and all control. However, that is poorly defined, because we don't... The movie never makes clear what the mechanism is that anyone uses to control the Matrix, because the analyst seems to have a very large and expansive set of abilities and powers to manipulate the world around him. But that all kind of falls apart and goes away later on when it sort of needs to, story-wise. But the powers of Neo and Trinity are able to sculpt the Matrix itself, just from their thoughts and desires, which is strange, because how does that manifest in a way where that is controlled? Also, the analyst talks about the suits at several points in this, meaning that there is some bureaucratic level above the analyst who has control over purging people from the Matrix, and he says that
was not the case with the architect, right? He was kind of the top dog.
Well, he wasn't the top dog, he was a program, but we never really understood what the hierarchy of programs was like. How do they manipulate things? Even when Neo goes to talk to Babyface, That is poorly defined as to what the avatar of that is communicating. Like, is there a council? Is there a hive mind consciousness of other programs that are not in the Matrix? Because I have to imagine it isn't just programs that are in the Matrix who are concerned with the governance of the machine cities. So it seems that there's bound to be a more complicated relationship, but then how does that interface with the Matrix? How do you remove people or places or things or change things or execute this failsafe that converts it from one thing to another thing, you know, to the old version of the Matrix, but now they can't do that because they don't have the source code, apparently, that is within Neo and Trinity. So it's all kind of...
Was that said at some point? I don't remember that.
The analyst kind of mutters something about that at the end. But the... Because that's why they aren't doing the failsafe, apparently. But it doesn't make any... It doesn't make any sense in terms of what Smith is rebelling against at that point. Because if you are capable of manifesting your desires as reality inside of this Matrix, as Neo and Trinity are supposedly capable of doing at the end of the film, then... How would he be constrained by anything? And when he is fearful of the analyst restricting him by chaining him to Neo, that is his main conflict with Neo, is if he kills Neo, then he won't be chained to him in the future. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense either, because then if Neo's not there, then there's no reason for Smith to not be there either. So then how would Smith not be chained to something?
Yeah, I don't know. That was the first one where when he shows up and goes like, the analyst said, if I kill you, they'll revert to the Matrix that I preferred better, where I was like duplicating myself a billion times and super strong or something. And then he like fights him and then runs away. But then later Smith shows up to fight the analysts or something, and he's like, you're not going to control me anymore. I'm going to do what I want. It's like, who is the bad guy according to Smith? Like, in your mind, who are you fighting? None of it makes sense. I don't know. You're strong. You're Smith strong, but I don't know if you're a program or they put you back in a human body. Anyways, it was nice that, first of all, I can't believe how long in this movie it took for Neo to go, whoa, you're Smith. It's like, you've been calling him Smith for a little while. Like, it's immediately clear to the audience from the first time we see Jonathan Groff, where he quotes a line up from Smith from the video game. And it's like, hey, remember when you wrote that in the game? It's like, no, that we all know that that's Smith, but it takes way too long in the movie for us to find out that Smith got put into Jonathan Groff's body. And I don't know what to do with that other than the fact that they wanted to put Smith in here and it's just, it was not successful.
I think really the part that doesn't work is that his goal is aimless and Jonathan Groff, lacks menace.
he's a little, he can be a little psychotic in the same way that Neil Patrick Harris can be a little intimidating in that kind of way.
But like, I don't know, like squirrely. He's not. He lacks that like piercing, staring straight through you. I will like dissect you with my eyes. Viewpoint of Smith, of Hugo Weaving Smith.
Absolutely. Somebody posted that clip from Hugo Weaving interviewing Morpheus when he's got the drugs in or whatever. It was a meme or something.
That was the one where someone's like, why do you even bother logging on Twitter? And it's it's the smell.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to get out of this place. Yeah, but like I watched that scene again, you're like, wow, this was so good. And Smith was so good in the original Matrix. And it was serious because that was the tone of the thing there. And Jonathan Groff fits the tone of this movie better. Like, and he fits a more modern audience better. But like, again, we've got these clashing styles. We've got a Matrix movie here and you are not like, you're supposed to be Smith, but you're not Smith. Like, we're trying to do a modern Smith, but there shouldn't be a modern Smith. And Smith should be Hugo Weaving and it should scare us and it should be frightening. But anyway, yeah. Like, that's not what this movie called for.
No, I feel like they're like, Batman needs his Joker, is like basically why he's here. And it's just like, but you know, there are good Batman Joker movies and there are bad Batman Joker movies and things like there. You don't need to just have the Joker there just to have the Joker there. Like I would like to see more of a reason. Also, it would have been a good opportunity to introduce, some other methods of control. Initially when they had, Jude in the movie, the kind of scummy, slimy, smarmy
buddy pal or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that that would turn into a more significant relationship, in terms of villainy than, where it ended up going, because he even calls him Mr. Anderson at one point. And, he has some, views in terms of talking about Trinity as a MILF, where it's repellent, and it seems like that should go somewhere, but it doesn't go anywhere at all. We never see Jude again after their weird FaceTime call.
He's a Matrix World nanny in the same way that Trinity's husband and children are Matrix World nannies. They're just sort of like, you know, whisper in the ear and reinforce the lies to try and keep them where they are. But yeah, he did seem like he was potentially useful for a larger role, but they sort of handed that off to his business pal, Smith, just kind of went nowhere.
Yeah, and also, if it had been Jude or Smith, it should have been more about raising doubt in his mind about his abilities and powers based on his false history of living this life in the Matrix these past 60 years, apparently, according to the film.
Yeah.
Because
what frees Smith's mind in this movie? At one point, you know, in the beginning of the movie, Jonathan Groff is sort of, he's acting like just a business partner at a video game company. Like, at some point in this, he goes like, oh no, I'm Smith, I am Neo's enemy. Is that just when they pull Neo out that suddenly he wakes up also and goes like, oh look, I'm Smith now?
No. It was when Morpheus met him in the bathroom when they pulled the fake alarm. And when they left there, the fire alarm went off and it set off the sprinklers. And if you listen to the soundtrack, they're doing something with either the score or the sound to sort of mimic the sort of helicopter blade sound that you heard in the scene where they rescue Morpheus and the sprinklers are going off inside of the building in the first movie. That was where Smith, you know, was really unhinged.
It's where he reveals himself and he calls him Mr. Anderson for real as a Smith.
Yeah, and so in this one, you have Jonathan Groff walk into this, you know, room with the sprinklers going off and all this gunfire, and he looks down and he sees a gun, and it triggers something in him where he goes and he picks up the gun, and he sees Mr. Anderson, and he is connected to his former life via this.
So he has enough of a sort of out-of-body flashback in the same way that Neo has been having them and suppressing them with pills, but this is enough to set him free and remind him of who he really was.
Yeah, because prior to this, he was just a terrible boss. but in this moment, then he realizes that he's been trapped. Now, like we've both mentioned, the movie doesn't do anything in terms of explaining how he exists or why he's trapped instead of removed, because he's not required for the power plant of anything to function. He leeches power. There's no reason to keep him.
Yeah, I can't think of a single reason why the Matrix wouldn't have immediately killed him, because he was a huge threat to the entire system previously.
Yeah, I mean, it could be possible that there is no way to delete him, and that's why he exists, but they don't.
Or maybe it's another one of those things where Neo has the memories of Smith and giving him a more friendly Smith to sort of just like fill that gap in his memory is like, oh yeah, that you have these very strong memories of someone named Smith. That's just your business pal, buddy, or whatever, that you designed to be the bad guy of your video game. Maybe that was the motivation there, but that seems like a big dice roll to put an actual
like superpowered
in your Matrix, like a superpowered bad guy in your Matrix.
Yeah, it's like he remembers a superpowered bad guy, so we're gonna make a secret superpowered bad guy.
Not gonna tell the bad guy he's superpowered.
We're gonna keep a secret from the bad guy that he's a secret superpowered bad guy. I don't know. The movie doesn't explain it. And when they do that cheesy Matrix thing of like looking at the screensaver in the real world, and they go, "Oh wow, I can't believe this. It's like he's an agent, but not." And it's like, yeah, I know, I get it. Like we know.
Yeah. Also, the whole, this is not relevant to the plot, but the whole like, we've been searching for you for so long, but you know, look at the body they put you in. You're this weird old bald guy. We didn't recognize you. We saw a guy named, you know, Thomas Anderson, but you don't look like Neo, so that's why we didn't think you were Neo. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
That's what tripped you up there. You had to work your way around that.
Yeah, that's
this guy looks wrong, but he wrote a game called The Matrix and is in charge of this video game company.
Yeah, these rebels will be foiled by CAPTCHA. I don't have a lot of confidence in their investigative skills.
Yeah.
It's a strange credulity to think that you could get away with just calling him that. I mean, I know narratively they wanted to have the thing of calling him Mr. Anderson and Thomas Anderson and that whole thing to echo back to that as part of it narratively, to mirror the earlier narrative in a meta way. But in terms of the believability that no one would be able to piece together that complicated 1,000 piece puzzle of who could possibly be the guy named Thomas Anderson. I don't buy that. They did an interesting job of like trying to show glimpses of reflections of himself. And also there's one reflection shot of Trinity in the coffee table where you see her sort of fake persona that we don't really see the rest of the film.
Yeah.
But
I don't know about you, but I caught Neo's reflection the very first time in his desk or computer monitor, wherever they showed it. Mm-hmm. And I honestly didn't need the other two or three times where they showed it. Like I got it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's there in case you blinked or something, but it also is one of those things where you're just like, so you didn't believe this could possibly be Neo because he's older and bald. Like those are the requirements that he have hair and be svelte or something.
And look like this person that you've never actually seen before.
Yeah. Like he doesn't match his driver's ID. So you're not going to let him buy a bottle of vodka or something. Like what is it you are trying to do here? Like, I don't understand. This is apparently such a clever deceit to modify his DSI so that they can't identify him even outside of.
I have a bone to pick with DSI. It was a digital self image or something.
Yeah, I think so.
In the first movie, it was called residual self image. And when did we decide that needed to be changed? Because it bothered me.
I don't know. I'm assuming it has something to do with the fact that saying residual self-image applied to when he appeared in the construct, he looked like how he looked in the Matrix, which is why it's
maybe
residual.
They just wanted to say RSI because that's, you know, wrist pain and stuff, and they wanted a cooler version of it.
Well, but also he doesn't have a residual self-image because it's not a residue of the previous Matrix. He's
well, they should have just changed it to something entirely different instead of one letter different because it annoyed me.
I'm sorry, Dan.
You should be.
But anyway, the I think it's worth mentioning also the incredibly botched attempts to remove Neo from the Matrix. They have the scene with Morpheus in the bathroom, which plays more for comedy than it does anything else, and it accomplishes nothing about his mission.
Because of the suit?
Well, not just because of the suit, but also his lines. Like, he tries to deliver the Lawrence Fishburne line when he goes out of the bathroom stall, and he's like, oh, and, you know, it's more... what is it? Is it more tragedy or farce? And he says it in the film, and it's like you can't. I know there's like hanging a lantern on it, but then there's like a limit to the number of lanterns you can hang on.
If there was a flushing sound after he had said it,
yeah, yeah. What if one of the doors opened and somebody was still in the bathroom? It's just
like at the end of Spider-Man Far From Home, where the kid comes out and washes his hands when Happy's trying to have the conversation with him.
Could be. Anyway, the scene is mainly comedy. It is curious how it all ends because time just sort of like unravels, and then he's at the analyst's office talking to Neil Patrick Harris, and reality has been reset so that it is not really what happened. But they didn't make no mention of what happened to Jonathan Groff after his realization from here until we see him again later when they go back to try to rescue Trinity. So there's a large unaccounted period of time where Jonathan Groff is just doing whatever, which is apparently finding exiles in the Merovingian.
And presumably communicating with somebody on the Matrix side to go like, let's make a deal. I want my power back. Well, he wants whatever power he somehow doesn't already have back.
Well, he's not making a... I think there's a misunderstanding. Because he's not trying to make a deal with anyone. He just knows that if he kills Neo and they can't have the version of the Matrix with Neo and Trinity, that the failsafe will revert it to the Matrix he prefers. So he's not negotiating with anyone. He just wants to reset reality and control things more easily and better.
Neil Patrick Harris also said, you've already triggered the failsafe by being removed from the Matrix, but I paused the failsafe because I told them you would go back in because I was going to kill Trinity.
Right, but if he kills Neo, then he's not coming back in.
But then
they'd have no reason to keep the failsafe on pause. The failsafe doesn't make any sense anyways, because why would you revert to the previous version of the Matrix since it wasn't working before, because it wasn't drawing enough power for you to use in the power plants? So yeah, I don't understand.
You know, yeah, the emotional Matrix is working. The emotional Matrix is better than the logical Matrix. So kill him and resurrect him again and then put him back in the thing again, because clearly you have the technology for that.
Well, it raises a question about like how they rebuilt him and like brought him back like from just sort of desiccated remains. Mm-hmm. So why don't you, if you have the capability to build him at least one time and to build Trinity at least one time, why aren't you just cloning Neo and Trinity and keeping them in parallel versions of this barely meet cute reality in order to like create superpower, if apparently this is so much power, so much more than fusion?
These two particular Neos and Trinities are destined for each other and blah blah blah, that you know, all of the power and things like that, which you know, continuing the story plot line here, is that they do eventually find each other and decide that they want to, you know, break themselves out of their prison here. And there's the whole heist bit in the middle with the girl who was the kid from the other movie, who's sad now that the Matrix killed her parents and stuff, and now she wants revenge by helping them get Trinity out of there. And then now the love story can start over or whatever, but then, you know, now we have the power, Mr. Analyst Matrix guy, to do, I don't know what.
Paint the sky with rainbows. But sure. Yeah, I don't know. The heist also is not even like halfway through the movie. The heist is like 10 minutes and it's like 40 minutes from the end of the film. It is weird in terms of how they chose to parcel out what they do with Carrie Ann Moss in terms of her conscious participation in the storyline. I like Carrie Ann Moss. I have always liked Carrie Ann Moss. I think that she should be in more things. And that one of the downsides of the original Matrix series is that she has a devotion to Neo as the one, and a romance based on that largely, where she loves and supports him in a way where he loves her, but there's an unequalness in the relationship. And I feel like one of the purposes of this movie is to rectify that sort of inequality in their relationship, because now it's not the one. It is the duo, something.
And like, they switch places. Like there are several things pointing in that direction, right? Like he's the supportive guy. He basically says like, look, Matrix, I'll let you do whatever you want to do. If she decides she'd rather stay in fake world, so it's on her. Like I'm supporting her decision, even if that means the end of my free will and or life. And then, you know, he's letting her take the lead. She has the power at the end there to help them fly. Switching from the leading man to the leading woman right up until like the female cover of the Rage Against the Machine song over the end credits. Like they do that very clearly and good, right? Like I get it. why yeah. it's in this movie, but that's more commentary than it is useful for the story.
Right, because it happens so late in the picture. The picture, what am I?
I'm talking to Mr. Scorsese over here, apparently.
Yeah, I'm Al Pacino in, what's it called? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're just a man in Hollywood over the age of 60, basically.
Beautiful picture. But anyway, so it happened so late in this storyline. She spends so much of her time trapped in her false reality that while her scenes are compelling in her false reality, I wish there was more time of her as a conscious participant in the story.
And it's complicated, right? Like he's got to empower her. He's got to give her the tools to make her decision. Like he's the freed Matrix boy, and he has to help her free herself if she wants to free herself. Like he has the power, but also he's deferring. So he's like, let me open your eyes, but only if you want to, which is a weird, like it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. But they sort it out with a very, I don't want to say tense, but a weird battle scene at the cafe surrounded by robo cops or whatever.
I hated that scene.
I hated it because her husband and kid were so whiny. It's like, we get it already. They're fake and they're just there to nag her into pretending that her fake life is real. But then, yeah, she does her turn and, you know, stop calling me Tiffany or whatever.
I just wish that was sooner in this. So that way we could spend more time with her, like as a conscious participant. Because it's just like her dream self is going through this whole rest of the movie. And it's very little time we spend with her consciously. And so they rectify, like her character's power and purpose, but they do it so late in the course of events that we spend so little time with her that we can't really enjoy it as much. Whereas in the first movie, right from the get-go, the whole point is like she's a total badass and can, you know, fight agents and stuff to a certain degree. And she's willing to do all kinds of daring feats. Where in this one, she's trapped in her awful mommy prison for most of the film.
But she builds and rides cool motorcycles.
Yeah. They give her something. It's throwing her a bone. But it would be good to have her do stuff. Because I think they also, like we're saying, there the scene with Agent Smith and that fight and the Merovingian and all that, it's just like, well, we kind of get it. Like, but that doesn't, it's not moving really things forward other than we're going forwards with Neo regaining his mojo, as they say. Yeah. And that helps break up their sort of rescue attempt, because the scene after that is Neo powerless against Neil Patrick Harris's monologue. I hate that scene.
He's all powerful and can do anything he wants in the Matrix, except the program can run at a higher clock speed than Neo, so whoops.
Yeah. But, you know, it and they don't explain why he doesn't do that later in the film, other than perhaps Neo can do what Smith did, but they don't show him do that, so it doesn't mean anything, I guess,
because he was freed at that point already, right? So like he theoretically would have had all the power he was going to have, unless it was just another believe in yourself and you can move faster than Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, well, he still doesn't have all of his power by that point in the film, because he still can't fly, and by the very very end of the film he flies, so you know he's working his way.
I thought he just comes in the door. I thought Carrie-Anne Moss flies into the side of the building and he just walks in through the door.
Yeah, he does, but then they fly together out of there over the credits with the Rage Against the Machine cover.
Mm. Okay, sure.
Yeah. But the I think that is just one of those things that's sort of left unexplained. I don't know if it necessarily needs to be explained, but if you're saying like the reason why this complicated prison situation works is because of this mechanism, and then you're just like, well, we're not going to address that or talk about it ever again, then it's kind of something I will think about a little towards the end of the film. also when Smith destroys the analyst, whom he had no prior knowledge of as his video game boss self, other than Neo was seeing a therapist, and he doesn't see that therapist. He doesn't see the analyst. How he knows that he was chained to Neo by the analyst, or how the analyst controls things, is left unsaid in the film. That Jonathan Groff just recites all this as given to Neo when they first meet there, and it's unquestioned. But then when Jonathan Groff pops up in the coffee shop and is capable of moving at the super speed of Neil Patrick Harris, he punches out Neil Patrick Harris and stops that little time thing. And then Neil Patrick Harris is trying to get the cat. I guess the cat resets things, but they don't describe how that mechanism works. And he has the cat at the end of the, they have the cat at the end of the film, and they're not like resetting anything. I don't understand. But anyway,
just cat. I thought the cat was just called Deja Vu as like a fun, silly little reference. Like, hey, remember that? That's from the other ones.
Yeah, but he's like reaching for it as if the cat does something.
Yeah.
So I don't understand, but he is shot by Smith until he like turns into little code pieces that disappear. But he has activated the swarm in lockdown, which creates the complicated scenario that comes afterwards. But then it's kind of weird because the first time I actually watched the scene twice because I didn't quite understand, because it seemed like he was asking to activate the lockdown in the swarm, but then was destroyed by Smith. And then Smith threatens that, that was your problem. You could always be, whatever and anyone. And I was no one, but I could be anyone or something. And then he disappears and it's the weird coffee shop guy. But when he disappears, it was like, oh, so is the army that's gathering outside Smith's like at the end of, you know, the last film, and it's no, they're all the like swarm bot things, and yeah, it's like, well,
it's
who's
like
controlling
a World War Z zombie crowd chasing you?
Yeah, it's very zombie film. But it's like, well, who's controlling those at that point? Because we saw the analyst just get shot. Is he not dead? Of course, at the end of the film, we realize he's not dead.
But he typed run swarm.exe, and then suddenly all of the robots are just throwing themselves out of buildings at them.
Yeah, but they don't, it's not clear to the audience, I would argue, at that point in the film, who is controlling the swarm, or why, what is motivating the swarm to do any of the things that they're doing. If the analyst is dead, it just turns out the analyst isn't dead, but they just don't communicate that. And it's like, well, was Smith controlling them? Because he says, this is the end of our unlikely alliance. And it's like, okay, so that means he's attacking him now? But he doesn't, I guess, because the analyst was controlling the swarm still, I guess, from wherever he was when he went away after being shot. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Which again, like, I don't know, maybe it's a cop out, but all I come back to with this movie is that it's a movie that takes place in the Matrix world. There's some action. There's some references to Matrix-y related things you want. There's a not particularly deep or complicated love story. And then that's it. Like that's all we got going on here. Like there's not really a deeper level of logic or philosophy to the whole thing. It's just you watch 2.5 hours of Matrix-y stuff doing Matrix stuff, and you're like, oh man, I remember the Matrix. Cool. I'm glad that they released another episode or another season of the Matrix on Hulu, and I watched it here.
I was thinking to myself as I was watching it, wow, this really looks like a TV show.
You're not the only one who had problems. Are you talking about the look of it specifically?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I apologies to Academy or whatever. I think he's probably won an award. John Toll. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's won an Academy Award for Best Cinematography in both 1994 and 1995. Not going to win one in 2022. Just FYI. Buddy, but yeah, it is.
The DP also did some of their other, like when I first saw it, and I was chatting with somebody about it, who will remain nameless. I was like, yeah, this very much reminds me of that older aesthetic of movies that we did about 10 years ago, kind of like the Cloud Atlas era. And oh yeah, the DP worked on Cloud Atlas. And then, you know, Jupiter Ascending was another one that I saw in there in the credits. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. I got it too. There. But it's I described it as sort of like that kitchen sink aesthetic where you've got like all of the saturated colors and hard light all at the same time. And it's like, yeah, we don't really do this anymore. We kind of pick a more, you know, a smaller color palette, and we use that for things. I mean, like in the way that the first Matrix movie did. Like this really has like a, I mean, maybe they're winking a nod to the video game world. Like it feels video gamey to.
Yeah, I would say it's not so much the saturation that bothered me, but the use of color seemed diegetic in some scenes and not diegetic in other scenes. Like the use of blue for the analyst's glasses in terms of production design and everything, and the use of a sort of blue cast to the world instead of the green cast of the previous films.
Yeah, is blue the new green? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, blue is the new green. It sort of meshed with the idea of the blue pill, and I thought that's what they were going for. But then
I did not catch that, but I think you're right.
But then Bugs's hair is blue, and Jonathan Groff is wearing blue, and some of the scenes in the Matrix are with golden, like daylight, warm light, or tungsten light and stuff, and it completely eschews the blue aesthetic. And some of the scenes that are in the real world return to that cool color palette, like in Io or on board the ship, like the previous films did when they went to reality, although it's not as desaturated and gray as it was in the previous films. So it made it into sort of a weird mishmash, because it seemed like color was such an important part in telling the story in terms of setting the place and giving the audience clues about where you were, that in this film, to sort of just say, like, it doesn't matter what color anything is, except sometimes it does, but it doesn't, is just sort of like weird to sit through.
Because, I mean, I don't think there was any confusion as to whether or not we were in the Matrix world or not.
No, but you know what I mean? Like in the previous, like three movies, when you were in the Matrix, it was green. When you were in the real world, it was a cool, like bleach bypass look that they went for. And it's strange to me that they don't, they chose not to dictate that sort of thing here in this film. You could say it's more believable to not have things so harshly colored, that, you know, we're not all idiots. And like you said, we can all tell when we're in the Matrix and when we're not. But it just made it seem like it was something that nobody was thinking about as consciously in terms of art directing as it felt like they did in the previous three films. And I think part of that is because of the difference in the people involved in this. And like you noted, John Toll, as well as a lot of other people, were involved in Jupiter Ascending, Cloud Atlas, and Sense8. And
I don't know. I was unfamiliar with Sense8, but I did see that in there.
Yeah. Well, Sense8 is their Netflix TV series that cost a bajillion dollars. And they did it with J. Michael Straczynski, who did Babylon 5. And so I was I had this vague interest level in it until I saw the trailers for it. And it was like, is this like Heroes? What's going on? This is weird. Oh, are they all just having an orgy? I don't understand what the show is. And so I kind of like rejected it. And then, you know, everybody else on the planet did, and it was canceled after two seasons and a brief movie.
I must have missed this entirely, 2015.
Yeah, it was something that was weird. They were passionate fans of Sense8, but then everyone else didn't like it, or was unaware of it because it seemed weird. And that seems about right. But, Brian J. Tyler, what's his face? He was in Stargate Universe. He's in here as one of the characters. Yeah, Brian J. Smith as Berg. He was just the sort of generic guy who was in here. And Max Reimelt, the German guy, the blonde one, he was in Sense8 too, and like just a bunch of other like randos who were either in the cast or in the production part of it, came along for the ride on making this. And it's odd, because I feel like if you're making a sequel to The Matrix, which had such like a tight and, you know, sort of focused aesthetic and look to it, to sort of not go back to exactly what you were doing before, to make it feel like an extension of it, is a conscious choice to make this stand out from the other three, perhaps, but it doesn't. I think I would have liked it better had it blended in a little more with the previous aesthetic. Because especially since you're using so much archival footage cut up against the reality of this film, or the non-reality of this film, that it's also jarring too. Because it's just like, wow, remember celluloid and it chemical processing, I guess. They did that digitally probably, but the it just had a very different look whenever we cut back and forth. But the other thing about that is the music too. Don Davis is not involved in this. They do reference Don Davis's scores for the previous efforts, and they don't use the techno music that they did like they did in the other three movies. You know, there's no Mona Lisa overdrive moment here. Which is, I think, a bummer, because I still like driving around on the freeway with Mona Lisa Overdrive playing, because that's just a normal thing that people do.
Which scene was that song from? I forget.
That's the car chase in the second movie.
Oh, sure. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just, or whatever. There was also the, what was it, Angels something, whatever, when he does the first, like, agent fight in the second movie. That one's kind of a famous, like, techno-y song. There's just none of that here. They just kind of did their own thing, and it's just sort of like this ambient and not quite as effective scoring.
I mean, part of it maybe just be that like technology is more a part of our lives now than it was back then, so it's less like, ooh, look, computers and stuff. Like we all get it, we understand AIs and stuff, but yeah, it is a very, very dramatic break from the other one. Which, you know, again, like that article you sent was interesting. The whole, you know, the idea that the Wachowski saw the reaction and the way the original Matrix, you know, philosophy stuff was used by everyone to justify all of their different viewpoints and sort of, you know, support them in ways that the filmmakers did not approve of or intend, such that in this movie, they basically said, well, screw you guys, I'm not even going to bother with that. I'm going to make fun of you and also just not give you any of that stuff. Like, I get how that would be an influence here, and that would be an inclination to say, like, I'm not getting deep and philosophical and trying to tell you anything that you're going to misinterpret and use the opposite of how I intended. I'm just going to make a straight up kind of actiony love story kind of movie. But again, that's sort of I forget how that article put it, but it said like this movie is much more tied to its surrounding context in the real world than the original ones were. And at that point, it's like, the movie loses something because of that. Like, I don't want to need to understand the context of society and the world at this given time to not even enjoy, just to understand the fourth movie in a series.
Yeah, what Dan is talking about is the New Yorker article I sent him from Alex Papademos. And that one, the quote that I was sending was, it served up without even the modicum of subtlety and egg hunt mystery that made the original Matrix such a durable chew toy for undergrad postmodernists. There's nothing to unlock in Resurrections. It's a movie whose password is password. Then again, if you were Lana Wachowski and you spent nearly 20 years watching the world's worst people hijack your ideas, you'd probably opt for placards instead of puzzles too. So I thought that was a pretty well put way of describing what's going on here. Is like there's no subtext here about stuff really. It's overt in what it is saying. Most of what it has to say also is about representation and agency and women and vaguely sexuality in just in terms of casting. Because I think this might also be the largest openly gay male cast in an action film, which is weird as a metric on IMDb, I'm sure. But it is, it doesn't have It doesn't have that weird, like, fake symbolism thing where people were like, oh, so the Christ narrative of Neo is blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And as you can tell from the mythology of this and the way the council scene unfolds and the philosophy and blah, like, vomit, you know?
Yeah.
That whole thing from the sequels that came out about, wherein everything was just so self-serious and awful. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that's absent from this because I hated that about those films. But that doesn't mean it's impossible to have something that has more like meat on its bones than this. Not in terms of like runtime or something. I'm not complaining about that. I just mean like that you can be explicit in what you're saying, but you can also have things that are left unsaid that reinforce it. And I feel like the movie just goes for the explicit route and doesn't have a lot of stuff that's left unsaid. For the supplementing that to reinforce it. So that's kind of a little disappointing, but I can tell that the viewpoint of the filmmaker is obviously not the same viewpoint of the filmmakers from the previous three films because of the time that has passed and the how their work has been received and reflected back at them. Because
it's almost that more of their personal viewpoint as put into the movie versus picking a story and adding a viewpoint to it. Like it, there's a lot more of the filmmakers going like, I saw what you did and screw you.
Yeah. And it's more effective. I feel like in the first act of this film, where we have the false reality, of what's going on with Neo and Trinity and Smith and the analyst. I feel like that is the best part of the film, perhaps, but also the part that is the least like the other three films, because it is not about extending the story of those films. That first third of this film is really dedicated to the sort of meta outside of the story, you know, commentary about making art and also the responsibility of people who make commercial art and things along those lines, because they're very overt in what they have in here, where the Matrix is a game inside of the Matrix, and Warner Brothers, who is called out by name as being the boss of Smith, they've been told they have to make the Matrix or Matrix 4, or someone else will make the movie without them, which is really what happened. And so, you know, that leads to the weird development hell scene where Keanu Reeves is in a montage of running on his treadmill, which is metaphorical and literal in this. And he's also in these meetings where people are saying the same things over and over. You can tell because they changed costumes. And they arrive at the same stuff about misunderstanding what the Matrix is. We have a weird Christina Ricci performance in here that sticks out. And she...
Was she one of the developers?
She was... It seemed like a market researcher. Mm. And...
Oh, yeah. She came in very briefly.
Yeah. She's just there very briefly. And she's got kind of an over-the-top performance for the amount of screen time that she has. But they have the whole thing of like, oh, authenticity and originality is what people associate with this franchise, so we need to keep that in mind going into Matrix 4. You know, it's really like putting a highlighter and then a pin and then some glitter and a puffy paint pen and like just circling it. It could not be more clear that all of the bad ideas that are said in this development meeting are things that have been pitched or thrown around in the presence of the Wachowskis at some point in terms of trying to entice them into making another Matrix film. Lily has said in the past, at least according to Wikipedia, that she wants nothing to do with making another one, but gave her blessing to Lana to make this. And Lana apparently didn't want to make one until after the death of her dad, a friend, and then the mom passing. I believe it was in that order.
Mm.
In 2019, and she was trying to process what that like effect had on things. And there's actually a good quote on Wikipedia from, I forget where the original article is. Yeah, this was from an Entertainment Weekly article. I couldn't have my mom and dad, yet suddenly I had Neo and Trinity, arguably the two most important characters in my life. It was immediately comforting to have these two characters alive again, and it's super simple. You can look at it and say, okay, these two people die, and okay, bring these people back to life, and oh, doesn't that feel good? Yeah, it did. It's simple, and that's what art does, and this is what stories do. They comfort us, and they're important. The origins of the Matrix Resurrection story as described by director Lana Wachowski. And so that,
can't argue with that. Bringing them back and making another Matrix movie does feel good, and it's kind of fun. But at the same time, you know, we know it's not the same thing.
No. And it, I think this movie doesn't try to pretend that it's the same thing either, which is good. If this movie had tried to say that it was the same as, like, in terms of
the best thing since The Matrix is Matrix 4.
No. Yeah, which I don't think this movie is doing. I think this movie is actually pretty subversive in what it's delivering to Warner Brothers, you know? But does that make it a good Matrix movie when measured against what the first movie was? Probably not.
I mean, yeah. If they're making another trio of movies and this is the start of it, and like this is the new tone for them, I think they'll be fun and enjoyable and successful to a point. But it's a reboot. Like, I mean, it's kind of miraculous that the Wachowskis are involved from, and you know, they did the first trilogy and they're still sort of involved, well, at least one of them is still involved in them now, but it just feels like a wholesale reboot that's just done, you know, close enough, well enough that we don't immediately reject it. It's a new version of the Matrix that's taking a different approach, but our bodies have accepted it somehow.
Well, I think this movie, I forget where, I think this might have been mentioned in the New Yorker article, I think this movie would have been rejected completely if you had made the same exact film, but it had been a different filmmaker attached to it.
I think just the credibility of the filmmakers made this fly.
I think so. It certainly gets the people involved who need to be involved with it. But it is also why you could be justified in doing your parody and comedy and satire of sequel making.
You don't think we would have accepted it if somebody else was making fun of the circumstances of the original filmmakers, because we'd be like, hey, you don't get to make fun of us. Only we get to make fun of us.
Yeah. Well, the clear example of that would be Paul Feig's Ghostbuster movie, where people rejected that for having any level of farce or comedy about the notion of ghostbusting. Mm-hmm. It had other major structural issues with storytelling, but just people were flatly rejecting it on the premise of what they were doing. And I feel like this movie would have also been flatly rejected on just like a different director being attached to it. Because there was apparently some development talk about, I think it was like Zach Penn was attached to do a version in 2019, but then they opted to go with the Wachowski version. So, you know, it's just, you could do all kinds of things with Matrix stuff. And I don't know how compelling it all is, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even when the Wachowskis did the first two sequels to this, they were greatly anticipated and not well received, by and large. I mean, they made a lot of money, but they're not, no one treasures them,
no,
to this day.
I mean, there's moments in them, you know, again,
car chase
or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, I agree.
And for any listeners who are unfamiliar, we did discuss the first three Matrix films when we did episodes 162, 163, and 164.
Mm.
If you want to go back and listen to those ones.
So long ago.
Mm-hmm.
2017. You know, so what the franchise needs to do now is, I mean, they can make two more or whatever if they want to, but they should stop, wait, I don't know, 10 years, and then let Denis Villeneuve reboot the original in a very serious, very dramatic fashion.
Oh, God. But there's no spaceships in it, so we can't just like look at large objects floating in the sky.
I mean, there's spaceships in the real world, sort of.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that he would be a good fit for this franchise.
Who else would be a good fit for the serious version of this, like the original movie?
I don't know. They may not exist. I don't need to. I don't need another retelling of this right now.
I basically just mean if they're going to make another Matrix movie and they're going to go the serious and philosophical route, who would do that?
I don't know. I mean, I would hope. I think this is one of the things that gets forgotten about The Matrix is that it is also the summation of a lot of other inputs into making it what it is. Like there's a whole like cyber, you know, narrative thing, like cyberpunk, all the stuff that was going on in the 80s and 90s with hacking.
Let's see you put Dracula in a movie now.
Yeah, I mean,
not only that, the remix of Dracula, I believe it was.
Yeah,
what song would we be playing in that club with Trinity and Neo from the first movie now?
I don't know, maybe something from Rita Ora. I don't know. I haven't been in a club, Dan.
I don't think clubs were like that back then either.
No, but it is one of those things where it's just like, it is so of its time. I mean, think about the mechanics of it too. Like, you need the landline in order to go around in the universe with your portal to the outside world. Like, God, when was the last time you saw a functional telephone booth? In this movie, they even say that, like, we don't need telephone booths to.
Yeah, they can go in and out of mirrors, windows, basically anything with a reflection. They've got glasses where their ship pilot can not just talk to them over cell phones, but sort of like VR project themselves into the world, which whatever is neat. I didn't need that, but it was nice to see how the technology had advanced in 60 years or something. But yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so because the original is just this summation of like ideas that were percolating at the time, it doesn't necessarily need to be that we need another Matrix. And the movie overtly says this, like, you know, you can just make new stuff. And it is that rejection of making something new for making something that is comforting, for making something that is nostalgia. And in terms of at the very end, when the analyst is complaining about the sheeple and what the sheeple will accept or reject, like, we are those sheeple who will accept or reject watching the fourth Matrix movie versus watching a new original movie that we don't know about.
If the second and third Matrix movies were better, we would have had a little bit more closure on the franchise.
Well, I mean, there was closure.
They had their own closure. I don't know that we had our closure.
I feel like we as an audience were not satisfied with the closure that we received.
Yes.
But in terms of like compare this to Indiana Jones 4. I'd rather
That's not a bad comparison to be honest, because there was the large gap. There was a much more modernized sort of style. I mean, they did a little bit more to kind of add that weird retro look to it that didn't really work out very well. And then they tried to tell a similar story, but like it was modernized for sure for modern audiences. But it's not a bad parallel. I think, yeah, this is the better version of that. Indiana Jones 4 and The Matrix Resurrections are kind of similar in their positioning to the original franchises.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I enjoyed watching this, not because...
can we title this episode... Neo and the Kingdom of the Crystal Matrix, just to piss everyone off before they even hear the episode.
I mean, Seth is spinning his refrigerator right now as we speak.
I'm writing it down as a title, even if we don't use it.
Yeah, but it's just I would rather I found this entertaining. Is it engrossing? Is it something I'm gonna like chew on mentally? No. Is it something I'm gonna think about the spectacle of how did they do that? Absolutely not. But is it?
Yeah, there was some other commentary about like, this one didn't break new ground technologically the way the first movie did with like bullet time and stuff. I was like, do we really? I don't know. I mean, it's great when they do that, but I don't know that we needed that for the Matrix to succeed.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things too where it's like you were breaking new ground because the tools for making film were changing at such a rapid pace that you could do things in that time frame that were inconceivable prior to it, and also unrealistically expensive after it. Like arranging all of those cameras to take photos in a spiral. Sure, great. You know what else works? Not doing that. Using computers. So,
and then yeah. You know, the next one, like they had an actual piece of freeway to go make a scene. Like that was, I think the narrative that I remember of the next movie is like they actually went out to built their own freeway and did this.
Yeah. Also, the second movie broke technological grounds, so to speak, by having the fight between Neo and all of the Agent Smiths in that courtyard sure. area.
Yes, and, when he was very spongy and bouncy.
Yeah, it looks awful. If you go back and watch it now, cloth sims are bad. The skin shading's bad. The skin resolution
the shots
and
where
detail.
They didn't bother doing CG replacements, and you can just sort of tell that all the Smiths in the background are people who just kind of vaguely look like mm-hmm. white guys of a certain age in sunglasses.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a total mystery that. You know, this movie is, you know, why doesn't this movie break ground? It's like, cause like, what are you going to do? Like, I don't know. Like, are you going to like do something weird just because you can do something weird? Or are you just going to like use the tools that have been pioneered by yourself and others from previous, like the previous 20 years in order to make this film?
Okay, here's what you do.
Yeah.
You make it in stereo 3D and the entire movie is built out of Matrix code point clouds. So it's not just like, multiplanes, like it's like real, you can see the depth of all of it, so we're looking through the Matrix.
Wow, I don't think that would be anything anyone could watch for 5 minutes, let alone 148 minutes.
All right, maybe they just do that for one quick little scene.
Yeah, well, I mean, but also, I mean, 3D's dead. Imagine making,
until Avatar comes out.
Yeah, right. Imagine making a film series that predates 3D and then a film that is a sequel to it that is after the era of 3D. So you skipped the bad part altogether.
Smart move.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, while this doesn't break ground and there's nothing in here that I'm just like, oh wow, it's still fine. Like they
yeah,
have,
it's fine. It's it was entertaining.
Yeah, the helicopter crashes into the building. It does the ripple thing. Woo ah. Like they do the bullet times. They do the, you know, trail. The bullets leave the little shockwaves. They blow up that apple. Like they do stuff. Like it's just that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't like blow your mind. So what? It's fine for what it is. The movie's not blowing your mind either. So I don't know what you're necessarily expecting to take away from at that point. So it's a good, entertaining, middle of the road, fine thing. It doesn't offend me as a piece of commercial entertainment that has been produced.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched worse things than this.
Yeah.
And
all of that is why I say this is a movie for 2021.
Yeah, it is.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, it did come out Christmas of 2021. We just, you know, may have watched it in 2022.
I'm just, it's dawning on me that we no longer live in 2021.
Yeah, we live in 2022. Everything's better. Yay!
As of a week ago.
Everything's so good. It's wonderful. No, mm-hmm. It's not. But, you know, it's
going to be a better year than 2021 just because the aesthetics of all the twos, I think, is nicer.
I was like, wow, that's really confident. And then you got to the part where you said why. And I was like, oh.
No, sorry. Faith in humanity and stuff.
Yeah, no.
Twos are cool. This is going to be a more memorable year.
I believe the twos are cool more than I believe faith in humanity. So, yeah. On
well,
that,
see, there you go.
On that note, on our faith in humanity, we should probably end this and fly off into the sky to another remix of mm-hmm. stuff.
We both slapped NPH upside the head and we flew out the hole in the wall.
Yeah, you did get to kick his jaw off.
Oh yeah, right. That was weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then she's like, that's for using kids, when she, like, threw him into the wall. But that seemed less bad than chopping off his neck or slamming his jaw into his face. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
For those who die, justify, da-da-da-da-da. Wake up.
It's a different Rage Against the Machine song.
I know. Yeah. I mean, we could also just sing Jonathan Groff songs, like, from Hamilton, you know?
Yeah, exactly. He should have sang, "You'll Be Back," right?
Yes,
like, you know, he'll be back to the Matrix.
Yeah. This is what they could have done. Is there could be a cut of that, you know, for the trailer. Just put that together instead of the Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, we didn't even talk about Jefferson Airplane. Like, I immediately had to go make sure I had White Rabbit downloaded on my phone, because that song, so it works so well. Like, I don't get tired of hearing that song and thinking about the world of the Matrix. Like, it tied in so well to the whole, just like the world building and just the original one. That just listening to that song is just like, yeah, remember how cool it was when the original Matrix came out, and just this, like, I don't know, it's not mind expanding like a drug or something, but the Matrix, you know, there was stuff to think about. It was cool. And that song works very well with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like it.
I thought it was too literal.
Well, you know what?
And this is the part where we end the podcast with it playing.
Do, 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 do. Very weird song. Like, I mean, uh-huh. who ends the song at the climax of the song? It's weird.
I don't know. I mean, they were on drugs, Dan. One pill makes you larger, one pill makes you small. Like, just a lot of drugs.
Mm.